And now the debate over those not getting vaccinated with our ethics professors. Wayne Vaught is the dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He is also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. Wayne, it's always good to have you here. Welcome.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. His latest book is Love and Lies, an essay on truthfulness, deceit, and the growth and care of erotic love. Clancy, always good to have you, too.
Thanks Welcome. So much, Steve.
Well, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie just came out in favor of a parent's right to choose when it comes to vaccination. My question, gentlemen, when the science is so clear on an issue like vaccinations, is there really another side of the coin that we should all be considering, Wayne?
Well, there are a number of issues and a number of sides of, I guess, the coin to look at. And one of the most important, obviously, is the impact of this on the child, him or herself, the one who's at risk of exposure to measles, mumps, rubella.
That's the foremost concern, it sounds like.
I think the foremost concern, polio would be another issue. I mean, the various types of childhood diseases, which have largely been eradicated, smallpox, which has been formally eradicated from the planet, so we don't have to worry about those things anymore. But if you have children who aren't being vaccinated, then they're really the ones at primary risk for contracting significant morbidity or even mortality of dying if they are not vaccinated. And then the question becomes, at what point does a parent become irresponsible? You know, we have seatbelt laws. You can't have your seat in child seats. You have to have your child in a child car seat to take them to the grocery store. And the likelihood of a child being injured in a trip to the grocery store is probably significantly mm-hmm. less than an unimmunized child, especially as herd immunity begins to subside. If you had a population where only 60% of the population was immunized, then you have a real high risk, probably much higher risk of injury to that child than of them not being properly seatbelted. And then the question becomes, well, why do we say that it's okay in one case to expose your child to risks? In another case, we think that it's parental negligence mm-hmm. Not to do something. And I think that's really what is at hand here. The science is very clear. These, other than the cases where there could be children with allergic responses to some of the ingredients of the vaccination, the vaccinations are themselves highly effective, very safe. The risk of injury is much less than the risk of injury from contracting the diseases associated with those. And then you have to say it just seems there's a point at which it becomes either parental irresponsibility in a way for not properly caring for their child, not giving them food, not giving them water, not taking care of them, not proper clothing and things. Or the issue, then, I think the one Rand Paul and others are probably going to be pointing to is freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And so you have Amish communities, you have mm-hmm. Other various types, either religious or cultural belief systems, who oppose certain types of medical interventions for their community. And then you have to say, well, is the balancing of that religious freedom against the protection of an innocent child, a young child who can't make those decisions for him or herself? Mm-hmm. In the balancing of those things, where do we come down? And I personally would say that the balance falls in the state becoming very parentalistic and forcing the vaccinations of the children potentially in cases to protect them from the serious harms that would result.
So, Clancy Martin, you have two sets of values sort of in collision with each other, at least based on what Wayne Vaught just said, the rights of the parents versus the rights of the kid, him or herself. How do you weigh all that?
Well, the question might not necessarily be so much the rights of the child versus the rights of the parent as it is the rights of the state's interest and the collective social interest in regulating how parents treat their children versus the individual parent's interest in having autonomy when it comes to decisions that are being made mm-hmm. about the upbringing and care of their own children.
Well, Wayne said that maybe it's not a question of autonomy. There is no right to autonomy here when you're a parent and your kid is in danger of becoming sick.
Right. We have lots of as Wayne points out, we have lots and lots of examples of cases where the state is stepping in, and Wayne uses this helpful term being parentalistic rather than being paternalistic, mm-hmm. the way we more traditionally talk about it. And I guess the question of how we balance these two opposing these two values that are in conflict, and why Wayne might suggest that at a certain point they no longer become in conflict, is when you have overwhelming evidence that a child is indeed significantly at risk if a particular thing, a particular action isn't taken.
And is this one of those cases in your view?
This seems to be one of the cases where we have not only risk to individual children, but collective social risk. Mm-hmm. That is to say, when it comes to the question of things that can become pandemic, can spread very quickly from child to child, we all know, those of us who have children, how frustrating it is in one sense, especially at this time of year, that you send your kid to school healthy and they come home sick. Surprise, yeah. Surprise.
Well, I send my kid to school these days, even when it's 2 degrees outside, and I say, right. Maybe it'd be a good idea to wear a coat. He looks at me like I got four eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know? So a little frustration there sometimes.
I was taking my 8-year-old into karate the other day, and there was snow on the ground, and she was refusing to put on her shoes. I was like, Portia, you cannot walk barefoot across the snow, even though we're going into karate.
Bad parent. Make me look bad.
We have values
exactly.
in this
if
family, not, by
if nothing
George.
Else. Yeah. Yeah, if yeah. nothing else, because of the way other people are going to look at me, honey.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
But
worse than they normally do.
Yes.
No,
yeah.
Now, something that is of worry to me, and that I think we should all bear in mind, is that, again, this is something Wayne has pointed out, we should be cautious, I think, about introducing parentalistic, again, to use Wayne's helpful term, parentalistic legislation, because...
Define that phrase for me, so parentalistic, so our listeners
sure,
are staying
absolutely.
With us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Traditionally, we talk about when the state gets involved in controlling the rights of the citizens, we usually justify that on the basis of a principle that goes at least as far back as the philosopher Plato called paternalism.
Mm-hmm.
Plato didn't call it paternalism because he spoke Greek, but it comes from the Latin pater, meaning father. And it is a justification of interfering with your rights when you are no longer acting in your own best interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about a seatbelt law, and to use Wayne's example, that's a paternalistic law. People tend not to act in their own best interest, so sometimes the state has to jump in. Why, when it comes to questions of immunization, paternalistic laws seem particularly well justified,
mm-hmm.
is that you're not only putting your own child and yourself at risk. I mean, if your child gets sick, as we all know, again, from the kid going to school and getting the flu case, it's that much more likely that you're going to get the flu, that you're putting your own health at risk. But more to the point, you're also putting at risk a whole bunch of other people's children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
so... that's what we normally call these principles of paternalism. The reason I think Wayne's term parentalism is a helpful one is that it puts it squarely in the context of what we're doing and in this situation, which is it's not so much we're thinking of what the father ought to do. We're just talking about what parents really ought to be
mm-hmm,
doing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the state will assume that parental role and to step in and say that there are situations where we will take control and make decisions or force certain types of decisions as the parent.
And they do it in a variety of cases. Right. They do it during divorce when they appoint a guardian ad litem that represents the children independent of either parent. They do it, when they – but that this is also the reason why I think we should when we're talking about paternalistic or parentalistic, that is, when we're talking about laws when it comes to how we raise our children, our moral antennae ought to be tingling
mm-hmm.
because there are some rights and liberties which seem to be so important to individual well-being, mm-hmm. to our very basic notions of having a free society. And one of those, I would argue, one of the most intimate personal rights and liberties that we have in our society protected is the right to, you know, to have children and then to raise those children in a way that we understand as appropriate,
right.
So long as, of course, we're not putting them, we're raising them in some way that is going to cause them physical harm. So that's the where it gets tricky.
Let me get our listeners involved here. Should parents have the right to refuse vaccinations for their own kids? At what point is not vaccinating your child considered negligence? 816-235-2888 is our number here. Big issue in the news right now. Again, 816-235-2888. Give us a call and weigh in here. I thought Senator Paul from Kentucky, he made an interesting comment the other day on CNBC. He said the state doesn't own your children. Parents own the children. And it is an issue of freedom and public health, he said, in relation to this vaccination issue. At what point can kids make up their own minds, make their own decisions, Wayne, when it comes to issues like this one?
You know, the idea of ownership of children is a concept that we have for at least a couple hundred years have tried to get away from.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That the idea that you own your children, that they're your property, that your wife is your property. Yeah. I mean, these are all concepts that have long since hopefully passed by the wayside.
Yeah, kind of crazy ideas.
You know, mm-hmm. I don't think, and I think he's emphatically wrong, that you own your children. These are human beings that you have created, and mm-hmm. they are living amongst you, and you are entrusted by the state to within the civil society in which we live to with broad discretion about how to raise them, whether they go to church or not, what types of books that you have in the house, what types of meals, are you vegetarian, are you not? I mean, there are lots of parental decisions that can be made. But in terms of the ultimate responsibility is that these children have to be brought up in a home that's healthy, productive, and there are certain requirements that we put on. You can't not educate your children. You can homeschool them. You can send them to public school. You can send them to private school, but you can't opt out of educating. With the Amish, we still have to educate, but they educate up to eighth grade, I think it is, a certain mm-hmm. level. And then they, you know, and so there are certain rights of religious freedom that we respect for parents to make those types of decisions. But, I don't think ownership is the question, and it's the wrong thing to be focusing on. What we should be talking about is protecting the best interest of these children until the time at which they're able to make decisions for themselves. And that's where your next question, I think, really comes into play. Obviously, two-year-olds can't make their own decisions. They're going to, you know, they don't like shots. They don't want to go to the doctor. But some point, and there's no magical moment, it's certainly not 18 when you're legally recognized as having these rights for yourselves, somewhere around 13, 12, 13, 14, and it depends. Studies have shown children with chronic diseases even earlier than that can make very competent decisions about their health care because they have been a participant and have experienced that illness and can probably make as good health care decisions as some 25-year-olds or 21-year-olds I know, much better decisions than some 21-year-olds I know. But then as they go through adolescence, you begin to develop capacities in order to appreciate and make certain types of decisions for yourself. And the principle of autonomy is simply a reflection that a person who has the capacity to make meaningful decisions should largely be capable of making those decisions.
So don't be hung up on the number 18 when
it comes
to this.
No, yeah. Hanging up on the number 18 is crazy. Now, you do have to have a legal standard. You can't. Mm-hmm. You know, though courts will recognize there are issues of mature minors and there are emancipated minors, and courts have recognized certain minors prior to the age of 18, endowed them with the legal rights to make decisions for themselves. Oddly, the pregnancy in many states is in and of itself. So you have a 13-year-old who's become pregnant. They are now emancipated. They can make health care decisions for themselves and for their children. The same 13-year-old or 14-year-old boy can't make his own health care decisions.
Right.
But that doesn't really reflect their psychological capacities to engage in those meaningful
decisions. And one thing we should
just
remember,
real quick, I want to get some phone calls.
One thing we should remember, Steve, is that when we're talking about contagious disease, it's a little bit different than just wearing a seatbelt, for example, because you're impacting a lot more people potentially than just yourself.
Okay. Ephraim from Lee Summit. Ephraim, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about childhood vaccinations and the ethics of that. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Just a quick comment. I disagree on many points of your guests, but I do respectfully disagree. The idea, I think what's being confused here is ethics versus morality. And I think there's a presumption of the state or academics to always assume that if a parent makes a decision, it's going to be unethical rather than saying whether or not it is immoral. We all have principles in which we are guided by. And I think sometimes when you're talking about a subject like this, it appears as though, well, a parent is incapable of making a decision which is morally substantiated based upon whatever their belief system is, rather than allowing the state to do it as if the state is moral. And I believe that on many occasions the state just does – it acts in its own best interest. And I don't see the correlation between the state deciding, oh, well – It may be a pandemic or epidemic, so we best know how to deal with this particular situation.
Clancy, give him a shout here. What do you think?
Sure, I respect very much this kind of knee jerk reaction, which is I think a healthy one to be suspicious about the state telling we should always be. That's part of being an American. We should be suspicious about the state telling us what to do about our private lives. Absolutely, and we should when it comes to questions of morality, to use the caller's term, we should recognize that, yes, morality, so to speak, starts at home. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the state, we do have to have legal and social order in any functioning state. And to maintain legal and social order, there are certain kinds of basic things we have to worry about. And one of those things is health care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ephraim?
Yes.
You want to respond?
Yeah, well, and I understand that, and I do realize there's sometimes we start down a road when it comes to diseases like smallpox and things of that nature. We start down a road, and then we start a process called immunization, and then now it's become so prevalent now that now the immune system, which is the strongest proponent we have as relates to fighting pathogens in our body, has been so suppressed. We found this out in a bunch of examples, like antibiotics.
Right.
And so what happens is there's this perpetuation of science, what is called science, that we need it more because now we've suppressed the immune system so much to now we need these things. And I understand that there's a public interest here. And now we've gone down a road that we've gone so deep down the rabbit hole that I believe that now this is the only response. But one thing that we have discovered.
Yeah, just wrap it up, Ephraim, so I can move on here. Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say one thing that we have discovered is as we continue to go down this road, we need more and more and more remedies for things that the immune system can no longer respond.
I got you. And Ephraim, very interesting comments, and I appreciate it. Any thoughts, Wayne, you're –
well, I would an immunologist could probably respond a little bit better. But I mean, the vaccinations are using the immune system. It's an immune response that's being created to fight these diseases. So I don't think that the science that's being articulated here is exactly spot on.
Okay, let's move on here. David from Lenexa. David, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yeah, my question was why we don't require the immunizations for more things, including like the flu, that the herd immunization seems to be really applicable to.
Why not more immunizations? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could I think easily argue that the issue becomes again one of freedom and one of risks and the right of individuals to make these sorts of decisions for themselves.
But
and
maybe the flu he's talking about.
Well, the flu is exactly right, and the flu is a lot more complicated and complex because you have a variety of strains of the flu virus, and they're trying to figure out each year which ones are coming through. It's very
and the one
expensive
this year I've heard
that.
Is not supposed to be all that effective anyway.
Well, the vaccination itself, they kind of misguessed which one was going to be prevalent,
right.
Though the vaccine, I understand, still will protect you against the strain of flu, which is out there that it's supposed to protect you against. It's just there was another strain that's floating around that they didn't quite anticipate. And so the vaccine is not going to be or may not be as effective as they had hoped. But here you get into the risks and who should be immunized and those who are immunocompromised, the elderly. There are particular classes of people that we try to focus on the immunization process. But here you're largely talking about adults making mm-hmm. decisions for themselves as to whether they want to be immunized. And, with children, when we're talking about child immunizations, we're talking about a class of people who can't make those decisions for themselves. And it sort of raises a unique ethical dimension to this as to whether the state should impose it if parents are unwilling to make that what we would deem to be the proper choice.
David, thank you for the call. Let me grab one more before a break here. Let's go to Dennis from Kansas City, Missouri. Dennis, welcome to our ethics professors. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I do believe that there should be made available the option for the choice of the parents whether to immunize or not because of the questionable effectiveness and safety of some vaccines. And specifically, Merck's MMR vaccine is presently in federal court where it's alleged that Merck has perpetuated fraud with this vaccine for some time in its effectiveness.
Gentlemen, I appreciate the comments. Dennis, gentlemen?
The MMR vaccination has been proven safe and effective. There's no documents and no studies that I'm aware of that suggest that otherwise. There have been some linkages to autism or things that some people claim, but those studies have all been debunked. If there are potential complications from, I guess, from allergic reactions or things to the virus, to the immunization, those could be, I guess, legitimate questions to raise. But as far as my understanding is, it has been safe and effective. But again, I'm not an expert on this subject, so I don't want to talk about that as much as that if we can find that it is, in fact, safe and effective, what then are the ethical obligations to
provide? It just seems like there's always this natural resistance when people are told they've got to do something. And maybe some of that is healthy. My students express that occasionally at UMKC. Am I seeing that right, Clancy?
I think in this country we have a really cherished value and virtue, which is liberty, and particularly individual personal liberty. And we would not have achieved what we have achieved as a nation if we did not cherish this value of liberty in the way that we do. I mean, this country was founded on the notion that we should be suspicious of our government. And I think that's an important ongoing notion for us to maintain. Now, when there are overriding concerns and overwhelming data that the best way to preserve something like the health of the nation demonstrate, okay, we need some legislation and we have a democratic process and this is how the legislation gets passed through, then I think we can collectively agree, here's a case where the government can help us out. But we should always continue to have this suspicion, absolutely. We should recognize how important our liberty is.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin from UMKC. We'll take phone calls from Roger, Marsha, and Jay, and we'll also turn to this whole question of when can kids move in and begin making their own decisions. We'll talk about a case in Hartford, Connecticut, about a 17-year-old girl who refused chemotherapy. And later on this hour, Brian McTavish is here with your weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're talking about sort of the politics and ethics of vaccinating your kids. Lots of controversy surrounding that. I should point out that Central Standard takes a closer look at understanding the cultural context surrounding the decision to vaccinate. That conversation will take place on Monday morning at 10 o'clock. But meanwhile, our ethics professors are in the house, Dean Vaught, Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. Let's go to Roger here from Kansas City, Missouri. Roger, you're on Up to Date.
Good morning. My quick statement would be, yes, I believe the government does act in its own best interest, and it should, because we all make up the government that we are involved with. So if we don't have, what is best for all of us, we're in real trouble. And I believe that this deal with the measles is because people are lazy. They don't want to take care of something that's easy to take care of. And then you get an instance where it is spreading to more of the populace than is necessary. And they're talking about Amish and them not having having to partake of this. And that's because they're in a cloistered environment. They don't participate in a lot of what they believe is the outside world has to offer. So they aren't exposed to that. There's a lot of things that you can and can't do. And, you give up certain rights, and I hate to say that, but you do give up certain rights for everyone else. Whether it's your father, your mother, your sister, your neighbor mm-hmm. down the street. I get tired of people saying, well, that's my liberty. Well, yes, it is, but your liberty ends where mine begins.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it at that, guys.
Roger, interesting comments. Ted called to say along the same lines that states have no problem legislating things like not allowing smoking in public, but they don't prevent unvaccinated people from being out among the public.
Sure. I'm sympathetic to both of these comments. I think it's important to recognize that we are active participants in a democracy, and so we do mm-hmm. have a voice and have had an active voice in these decisions. They haven't just come down from on high. I mean, we're the ones who sent the people up there to that ultimately put these laws into place. I doubt that it is really, for most people, a question of laziness, however. I think it's really, for the people who are opposed to these things, I think they are opposed to them for what they consider to be really robust mm-hmm. religious and or spiritual reasons. And that is why the conflict is worth arguing about, because and important to argue about, because some of us have spiritual convictions that just deeply conflict with what is the social convention.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Marcia from Kansas City, Missouri. Marcia, you're on the show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I want to start out by saying I liked what that last caller said, because I used to be that person. I used to consider myself a nonconformist. And so when my kids were born, I really fought against them having the MMR. But I did get them vaccinated. But I'm saying that because when we talk about moral and ethical responsibility, we also need to look at the people that are willing to go out there and talk about without facts, the MMR, like Jenny McCarthy, mm-hmm. and sending a fear state to people, and truly like people like me. But when you really think about the bigger picture, and that's what I did, and I have a responsibility living in a society to others. So vaccinating my children or getting the flu shot, it is not just for me. And as far as children, this ownership idea, my thought is these children are children of everybody's, just as other children are. And had I not gotten them vaccinated and gotten to this point, I don't know if I would feel very good about myself thinking that they could infect another child. And there's another aspect. There are physicians who can refuse to treat children who haven't been vaccinated, and they have that right. So that's what people who take this stance, and I understand the spiritual, but it's not spiritual, it's religious.
Right.
Because you don't hold to things that block you unless they're beliefs which are religious. So I want to make that distinction. The only other thing I'll say is
go quickly, Marcia.
I didn't have the chickenpox vaccine when I was young, and I got chickenpox in an older age, and it was horrific, frankly. So that's the other thing to think about, too. You know, you're not looking at it when they're little, but those same diseases can come back, and they are far worse in your adulthood.
All right, Marcia.
You've gotten past all that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Let's go to Jay from Kansas City, Missouri. Jay, you're on the show.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. Would it be acceptable to charge higher rates of insurance for patients or children who don't get vaccinated? Of course, this would be difficult for Medicaid patients, but for private patients, you could think that, you know, since the vaccines are very cost-effective and extraordinarily safe, maybe it would be useful to try to charge higher rates to coerce people to get vaccinated.
Interesting. Wayne Vaught, higher rates of insurance here?
Certainly it would be an option. Now, the difficulty is you start picking on one thing. So do we charge higher rates for those who eat more Big Macs? Do we charge higher rates for people who mountain climb? I mean, you get into a number of risks.
Big Macs, yes. Mountain climbing, no. Yeah.
You know, there are lots of high-risk behaviors that we engage in. And so to try to ferret that out. But then here's a situation where you can at least narrow some things down. And I think insurance companies will probably start looking at this. You know, lifestyle choices. You already can get discounts if you do certain things, if you go to gyms, if you you know, see your trainer, you do various sorts of things that can promote a healthy lifestyle. Insurance companies are trying to reward people for doing that. And actually, in our plan at UMKC, if you got the flu vaccine, you could get a discount that they will give you from the healthcare plan for getting that vaccination. So, yeah, I think that's an idea that can be very good, but it does again get into that sort of issue of freedom and how far we're willing to push that.
You know, Clancy, let's talk change topic just a little bit here in the few minutes we have left. Let's talk about what happened in Hartford. There was a 17-year-old girl who recently refused chemotherapy. She's going through the Connecticut Supreme Court to decide whether she's mature enough to deny a life-saving procedure. Should minors be able to make these decisions?
Well, it is a really fascinating and difficult question. Because as Wayne pointed out earlier, and I should say this is Wayne's area of expertise. This is what he works on as a scholar. It's really hard to know, and it varies so much on a case-to-case basis, when a person is at a point where they are capable of making responsible decisions about their own health care, especially when it comes to end-of-life care.
Look how complicated it could get. The child, the 17-year-old, says no chemotherapy. The mom or dad supports them, and then maybe they're, you know, charged with negligence or something down the road.
Absolutely. You know. It can get very, very...
sticky, yeah.
Very, very sticky. And... I think that, I do think that when it comes to questions, particularly difficult ones when we're asking, will this person continue to live, they seem to be well-informed about the issue, that we should have procedures that allow for evaluating these things on a case-to-case basis, mm-hmm. maybe without quite so much legal intervention as we presently have, or to create a little more room for autonomy, because it just seems to me that if we can talk about meaningfully about having the right to life and we can see that you are fully rational – then it seems to me that there's some kind of fundamental injustice when you are not mm-hmm. able to make decisions about whether you're going to live or die. So I would like to see a little more sort of space for discussion between patients and physicians without the requirement of the intervention of law in order to make this work in a just way.
Yeah. At what point do we see in society, Wayne Vaught, where a parent is held accountable or accused of negligence when it comes to the care of a son or daughter and they've maybe refused treatment of one kind or another?
I think it's when they fail to act in a way as to provide what would be considered ordinary medical care or treatment.
Ordinary medical
care. And so, you know, if a kid were to fall and break their arm and you kind of don't do anything, you sit around the house and then they get an infection or something and they discover this, then you're likely to, you know, you didn't seek out, you didn't call the ambulance, you didn't go seek a physician when you were seeing obvious signs or symptoms that would lead an ordinary person to seek out medical care or treatment for the child. Where it gets complicated again is you get Christian Scientists groups who don't want any medical intervention, and so they'll pray for their children. And there have been cases surrounding that very sort of decision where parents have been found guilty of medical neglect.
And do they go to jail in some cases?
I don't know that they're – I can't remember any cases where they've actually served prison time, but they've probably been fined. They might have gone to jail for a bit or something. But there clearly has been prosecution against parents for failing to provide appropriate and seek out appropriate medical care. But this is where, you know, the issue when you come with the Boston case becomes so convoluted and complex, because now you have a situation where you're dealing with life-saving medical treatment. You're dealing with perhaps, you know, you're trying to get a few months, years of life, depending on what the condition is and the likelihood of success would be. And then it becomes a real value decision as to, you know, is what's the quality of life? How much life can I expect? What is it worth going through the pain and anguish associated with the treatment? Is the treatment worse than the cure, as it were, in getting me this expended period of time? And who should get to decide quality of life decisions? And I think typically we turn to, well, that involves a subjective value that really the competent person has to decide. And if you have a 15, 16, 17-year-old child who says, you know, I would just rather enjoy as best I can and comfort the next few weeks of my life than to go through potential a treatment that's going to be quite painful to get a few extra months of life, why shouldn't that be the decision of the person, the only person who's actually affected by that decision?
Yeah, what happens in a case,
directly affected anyhow.
What happens in a case like that, Clancy, where a parent and a child and maybe even a doctor all have different opinions as to how things should proceed?
Right. I mean, the ideal scenario, and this is actually one of the reasons why they have ethics experts in many hospitals and in many
– That's right.
Yeah.
They're on staff in some cases.
Yeah, very often on staff because usually actually at that point when one of these ethics experts like John Lantos here in town, for example, they'll say, John, we need some help. Exactly. We need some guidance here, because it's certainly true that before lawyers get involved, most physicians, most hospitals, most institutions recognize that these kinds of conversations should be lengthy and detailed and informed one taking place between the doctor, the child, patient, and the parent. And they do try to do it in a series of informed conversations before they, you know, before they call legal counsel and say, okay, now we've got a situation here. Probably in part to avoid the expense, but mostly, I think, because of the motivation of proper care. You know, they just recognize that autonomy is part of medical decision making. It must be, and it should always be respected. It wasn't always this way in America, we should say. Autonomy has become much more prominent in American medicine than it used to be. It used to be that doctors had all the power, really, when it came to this kind of decision making, or the vast majority of the power.
And that's changed over the
years.
That
really has changed a lot over the course of the past 30 or 40 years, and I think a change very much for the better. But if it can't be resolved, that's when we wind up in this cases like this Boston case, where all of a sudden the lawyers start arguing it out, and you get into really profound questions about what counts as informed consent and what counts as autonomy and when.
Well, again, the Central Standard takes another look at this whole issue on Monday at 10 o'clock. Join the show then. In the meantime, I want to thank our ethics professors, Wayne Vaught, Clancy Martin, both from UMKC. Interesting conversation, gentlemen. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much
for having us, Steve. You bet. I really enjoyed